accession number 23821, Reel 3.
Mr. Halliday, Reel 3. We're talking about your time at HMS Ganges at Shotley, around about February 44 to around about April 44, about seven or eight weeks. As you were getting near the end of the course, how did they assess you for where they were going to send you? You said there was an assessment. How was that done at the end of the course?
Well, it was... Actually, it did appear later on a written report, but at the time we were told how we had fared at the various sessions by the petty officer that were in charge. And as I said, I did quite good at gunnery and aircraft recognition.
What was the aircraft recognition course? You mentioned it, but we never actually covered it. I mean, what did you have to do?
Well, the kind of things that you would do, some of it was photographic. But others weren't. They had a rather large barn-like building, and the roof of it was sort of painted like the sky, and models of various planes were actually hanging from the ceiling, like, you know, and you would go in there and of course the point is, though, you had a piece of paper and you wrote down what it was. And as I say, that for some reason or other, it just happened to be one of those sorts of things that I got on well with. But then the crunch, really, as to whether could be accepted for, if you like, an AA course, was the eyesight. And what happened there was that you went into a room, and there's no windows in there whatsoever, just the half light to show you where there was a chair. And you sat there, and then the door was shut, and the lights went out. And it was pitch, absolutely pitch dark. And then the instructor, who was actually outside speaking through a mic or something like that, said, right, in front of you there is a dial. Call out what you see in times of clock. And there was this, because a lot afterwards the lights went up and you could see this round disc, and of course you could say 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, but you couldn't actually, even today you couldn't actually see it. You just, it was one of those sorts of things that you moved your head round, and but obviously it must have been effective, but anyhow, I got through that okay, and the next thing I knew was I was on my way from Ganges to Sheerness for a gunnery course.
The who with? What was the name of the gunnery training school? Or was it just...
No, but just the ordinary gunnery training. I know there was St Mary's was there. Yeah, I think it was attached to St Mary's.
St Mary's Barracks, or...?
Yeah, I think it was attached to St Mary's.
And this would be about April 44?
Yeah.
Ish.
Mm-hmm.
What was the course like? What did the course consist of?
Some of it was assault courses.
What were they like?
Well, climbing over obstacles, and at the end, in actual fact, there was Mission Impossible, that you had broken up into various squads and told, right, there's a command post there and you've got to get round and take it. And it was Mission Impossible, because there was no bloody way you could do it without being detected, because the ground was as smooth, as clear as the blazes. But there you are, it was just a tax to brain, I suppose.
How tough was it physically?
Hmm?
How tough was it physically?
It made you puff. It made you puff, but by this time, of course, we had toned up a bit. And but, I mean, it wasn't... I don't think it was anywhere near the sort of training, perhaps, that the chaps in the army would have been getting. Because, I mean, we were going to end up on a ship. We weren't going to be sort of boot-slogging. And then there was the gunnery... and of course then we did fire the guns.
Now, tell us about that. Tell us about the guns that you fired and how you went about it, what the gun drill was, as much as you remember.
Well, the point was that obviously you started off with those, we'd learned a certain amount of this in our basic training, was how the gun functioned, how to start it, how to stop it, and also how to maintain it.
So how did they train you? Say the Ehrlichman, that's the thing you're going to be on.
Well, that's the point. Okay, yeah, the point was that the Ehrlichman would be put there, and I would, after a while, I'd been shown it first of all, but then, right, now strip it down, and you would strip it right the way down, and I mean right the way down to the little nuts and bolts. Clean it, oil it, now put it back together. Now that was, of course, the point, see? But, again, fortunately, I was able to do this and do it quite comfortably. I can remember some of the other lads fumbling a little bit, like, you know, and where's this bloody bit going, like, you know? Because the trouble was, I'd be a petty officer there and he'd say, oi, cut that out. But, no, it's just one of those things that, as
what
I say...
What about firing it? What was it like to fire? How did you load and fire the Ehrlichman?
Well, the Ehrlichman, in actual fact, I mean, you've got a drum with... they're 20mm shells and they're 60 to a... I think it's 60 to a drum. And you would have a number two. He would be... your locker, your ammunition locker would... It's sort of... they'd lay it out as if it would be on a ship, and the number two would bring it over and then just load it, slap it in. It was nothing complicated.
Just slotted in?
Yeah, just slotted in, yeah. And it was, and of course the point is so that the shells would be usually three types. There'd be tracer, armoured piercing, an explosive, I think they called. Yeah, that was it. And that's another good thing I did like about the Ehrlichman was, of course, when you was firing it, because in actual fact you had about every third shot was a tracer, you could actually see your line of fire, like, you know.
What was the actual contraption for firing? As if someone had never seen an Ehrlichman, where would you stand? How would you fire it? Where would you stand? And what was
it? No, you strap yourself in. Okay, you got shoulder. It's sort of a shoulder holster, and you strap yourself
you've
in.
Got two. What were the two things there?
That's it.
The handle.
And of course, you got the sight, open sight there, and you could just swivel it around. Later on, of course, I moved on to in later experience onto twin Ehrlichmans.
So you had twin like handlebars, or.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was it. It was just somewhere to hold your hands.
You could do it from side to side and...
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had the two.
Yeah.
Did it move easily?
Yeah, they moved easily. And the point is, though, that your gun mounting would be sort of two steps, like, you know, so you could step down to get to come right...
fire at something that was really high up.
Yeah, well, you could more or less fire directly above you, like, you know.
How did you actually fire it? What was there a trigger on the? Where was the trigger?
I'm sure the trigger was on the right hand side.
The right hand
of the grip. Yeah, of the grip.
Was it a twist or a press?
It was press. Of course, we would have targets to shoot at.
What kind of targets? Were they stationary or moving?
Some were stationary, but the point is, though, that then we would also have aircraft go over with the dragnets.
The drogues?
The drogues, yeah. And also, just off, as you know, Sheerness is in the Thames Estuary. And A mile out in the estuary was a wooden tripod. And I know it was just over a mile out because, well, at least I was told this, that you could set sights the gun, the larger guns on it. And one Wednesday afternoon, I went to, there's a bit of a beach there, and I went down, I don't know why it was, but it was, I'd finished a course or something like that, and had some time off. And it was a nice day, and I decided that it would be a bad idea to swim out to this wooden tripod, see, which I did. And mine, being rather naive at that time, I thought, well, when I get out there, because it's a nice sunny day, I'd climb on it and, sort of, because, I mean, obviously, they were quite wide hunks of wood. And I thought, well, I could have a rest up there. But when I got there, of course, the point is it was absolutely covered with barnacles, and you couldn't touch it. So I swam around it. Oh, there's only one thing, I better start to swim back. And I started to swim back. No, I've got no worry at all on this. And just doing a steady side stroke. And I suppose I've been going about quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and I looked over my shoulder to see how far I had gone. There was no bloody tripod there. And there's the tripod dead level with me. The bloody estuary's only on the ebb, isn't it? Bloody Thames estuary's on the ebb. Oh, then it was a question, not panicking, but it was a question of serious swimming. It must have took me somewhere around about 3/4 of an hour to get ashore. But I was absolutely knackered. And I can remember, in actual fact, that I suppose I knew that the beach showered, stopping periodically to see if my feet would touch the bottom. And I suppose I must have got about 50 yards from there when I felt my toes. And from then on, I didn't have another stroke in me. It was just a question of sort of wading through the water. The unfortunate point was, of course, that I was on a bloody mussel bed, wasn't I? So it didn't do my feet a lot of good. But you mark that down as some experience in life. I wouldn't do it again. But these are the sort of things that, and so really, I mean, I was well prepared, in actual fact, I was supposed to go to sea, insofar as the water didn't have any sort of, had no fears as far as the water was concerned.
Now, any other trade, you know, the stripping down and firing the Ehrlich, did you do the other guns as well, the pom-pom?
Yeah, but as I say, it was this, it was the Ehrlich really was, and I think this was recognised, to be quite honest. And I don't know whether, in actual fact, you know, they sort of carry this ahead with regards to wherever you're going to be posted or anything like that. But, I mean, as it turned out, when I went on a good order, there were no Beaufort or pom-poms on there.
So there was a concentration on the Ehrlich, as far as you...
Well, as far as I was concerned, yeah.
And it was an anti-aircraft.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't anything else.
And then, of course, when I'd finished there, I qualified for and I became an AA-3.
A what?
AA-3, anti-aircraft third. Right, then you could become second, and then...
Still just an ordinary seaman, I presume.
I'm an ordinary seaman, but the point is that did accelerate your move towards being an able seaman. You know, it helped. And also it gave me an extra...
What were the tests like?
It also gave me an extra tanner a day.
What were the tests like that you had to perform, you know, at the end of... I mean, how did they sort of examine you to qualify you?
Well, it was ability in actual fact. I mean, obviously, to be able to handle the gun, a degree of, if you like, accuracy... But also, as I say, to be able, in actual fact, to maintain maintain the gun. I mean, that was the important
part. What about maintenance? I mean, what maintenance was it required on the Oerlikon?
When later on, in actual fact,
or would it be better to look at it when you're on the boat?
I joined the ship. The point is, though, there's no overlap from it, but the point is, though, that you would be responsible for your gun. And the point is, it was your gun. And the thing is that, okay, if it needed stripping down and cleaning, obviously after firing it did, it was your responsibility to do it. Full stop. Nobody was there to overlook you and inspect it. When we was in Liverpool,
I'll come back to it, yeah, because I can see that that's probably best dealt with on the good old. So where were you sent after you? How long was the course? It's roughly April. I mean, it's difficult to get the dates exactly.
Yeah, it is. In actual fact, I suppose really we must have been moving. Now, when did I join the good old? I think it was. Yeah, this would be somewhere. I think the course finished somewhere around about May.
So around about April to May. Mm. You didn't join the Bullen or the good old on commission. You didn't go out.
I didn't go to America, no.
So what happened when you finished the course? Were you sent straight to the good old?
No. In actual fact, I was. I'd qualified then, in actual fact, for my first leave. So I went home with Jolly Jack. And I went back then to Chatham Barracks. And I wasn't there very long. And I got a draft, and that was to the good old, who at the time was in Gladstone Dock in Liverpool. I travelled up with a warrant with a young bloke, he was a stoker. And eventually, from New Street, not New Street, Lime Street Station, got the tram down to Gladstone Dock. And when we went up the gangway, there was a petty officer, quartermaster obviously was on the out there, but then there was a petty officer by the side of him. And we went up and reported to him, and he didn't seem to bother much about the stoker. He said, just sent him off. And he said, well, you better come with me. Drop your kit there. And he marched me off into the office where there was a sub-lieutenant who was going to be my divisional officer. Now, what was his ruddy name? I'm not sure whether that was...
I just looked it up. It's Lieutenant Paul Mallett, a South African.
Yeah. He was the gunnery officer.
So what was your first impression of him?
Not much.
What was he like?
The first impression was that the petty officer took me into him like, and I'd given him me sort of papers to the petty officer, and he handed them over, and he looked down through them, and, oh, right, he said, you're all right on Oerlikons. I said, yes, sir. And then he just turned around and said to the petty officer, take him up to so-and-so Oerlikon, he said, and settle him in. And that was it, really. Wouldn't welcome to the ship or anything like that, like, you know. Well, as I say, he was a South African. I mean, he had that bit of a South African, the Boer sort of accent. And the petty officer took me up, and I had this Oerlikon was on the starboard side. It was the first Oerlikon abaft for the bridge, and more or less level with the bridge, just a little bit abaft of it.
On the starboard side?
On the starboard side, yeah. And he said, right, son, he said, that's yours. So, right, thanks very much. He said, well, you better come back now. He said, you know, you found your spot. He said, you better get back down the gangway and pick your kit up. He said, and I'll take you down to the mess.
Now, tell me a bit about, what was the setup of this Oerlikon on the side of the bridge? What could you see? Where were you on the ship?
You've got the main deck, but then you've got what they call the super deck. That's the deck above it. And there wasn't a blister as such, but It was obviously right to the side of the ship, like, you know. And I don't know if you can see one there. No, you haven't got... just abaft towards the stern, just behind the bridge. And that was where I was come to later.
That picture's the one in front.
Yeah.
And what about your ammunition locker? Was that...
Well, the ammunition locker was situated right behind the gun. But, of course, you had a number two, as they say. That was his job to bring the ammunition out of the locker, which the locker was kept shut all the time, apart from action stations. So it was very important that was a thing that was stressed, that the locker had to be severely secured unless only opened during action stations.
Now, what were your first impressions of the ship? Because it was your first ship, but it was also they were funny little ships, weren't they?
Well, I mean, the point is, obviously, I'd had no experience of ships up to that stage. But the thing that struck me, quite frankly, was when I went down to the forward mess deck, was how small the messes were like, you know. I mean, there was a table or a bench, which was a permanent fixture, with two bench seats either side, and I think there was 10 of us. I think there was 10 of us in there. We had a leading hand. His name was Wilcox.
What about the mess? Tell us a bit. So you had this table. What about you didn't have hammocks, did you?
No, on there, that was the point. Of course, that was the other thing. When I arrived on there with my kit, of course, I got the hammock. And the petty officer said, well, you ain't going to need that, son. At the time, I didn't realise what he meant. Like, you know, we're all going to bloody sleep on, like, you know. He said, you'll have to stow that away. And there was an area to go and stick your the hammocks. Which was a pleasant surprise, because obviously I'd used the hammock in the barracks and at a gunnery course and that sort of thing, place.
Were the bunks stacked up, or, you know, one on top of the other, or were they?
Yeah. But
what were they like? Were they comfy?
They were very comfortable.
You preferred them then?
Oh yeah. I mean, an hammock was nice. An hammock was very, very cosy. But the point is, though, that. You know, you've got to sling it, because you can't leave them strung to you in a day. You're virtually rubbing shoulders with the person next to you, like, because there's very limited space. These bunks were very, very comfortable. You'd sleep like a, you know, top on them.
Now, there are a lot of American fixtures and fittings on some of these boats, some more than others. Do you remember any? I mean, again, you're inexperienced, so you might not have noticed that. Things like the laundry, ice machines, water machines.
Well,
like
of course, here you see, I've got to rely upon what, you know, the other lads, future messmates, telling me that when it first came over from the States, they had coffee and tea machines, ice cream making machines. Had a wonderful laundry. The only thing that apparently we weren't happy with was their heads, their toilets. They had the trough, and the Admiralty weren't going to have any of that. But having said that, the Admiralty wasn't going to have tea and coffee making machines or ice cream making machines, so they were all ripped out.
So that's all gone when you got
that was gone, yeah. But the lads told us all about it.
How did you settle in your mess? I mean, who were the characters in your mess? Well, what were they like as a whole? If you know, I mean, sometimes it's difficult to put a name on people.
The strange thing was that I mentioned earlier, I did my training with a lad called Norman Keats. And strange point about it, Norman had been drafted to the Goodall a couple of days before I found myself in the same mess as him, like, you know. The others were, most of them had in actual fact been on board there since and picked it up in the States. We had a killick, the leader seaman, a chap called Wilcox, and he was a smashing fella.
What was so good about him?
There was no question of anybody taking a liberty with anybody else. He wouldn't stand no sort of bullying of any kind whatsoever. He was dead square. He was a regular. It was a two badger. Yeah, he was a two badger.
What was his first name? Well, you know, it's all right. But Wilcox.
Wilcox, yeah. His name is on the list of those.
He was killed.
He was killed, yeah.
But he treated you well right from the start.
Right from the welcome, yeah. The point is, though, that you couldn't have wanted to have had a better sort of person in charge, you know.
Did he make allowances for the fact you were wet behind the ears?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the point is that he went out of his way, like, you know, to tell you where things were, like, you know, and particularly where you could go and have a shower, because that was an important point on a small ship like this. The cleanliness was a terribly important thing, like, you know. Well, there's the shower down there, and you expected the bloody will use it, like, you know. In other words, he was, in a way, saying that, you know, we don't tolerate people that are not clean or anything like that, but nothing bombastic about it. It was done in a way that, as if he was just showing you around the place. As I say, I had no complaints on, no complaints whatsoever.
What about the rest of the lads?
They were a mixed bunch. Well, the whole point is, of course, that, as I say, apart from Norman Keynes and myself, we, most of them had picked it up in the States. They'd had 3 months of jolly in the States, and they did have a wonderful time, apparently. Seen a little bit more sea time than we had obviously seen. I mean, it was, you know, sort of a little bit of leg pulling or something like that, but I mean, nothing vicious. You wait till we get to sea, like, you know, you'll soon take that colour out of your face and that sort of business, like, you know, well, I mean, this was it. But, and then the point is, of course, that it was strange that within 24 hours we left Liverpool to go to, was it Belfast or Londonderry? I'm not sure, but we was, on the way, we was carrying out some calibration tests. So it took us about 5 days.
What were calibration tests? Can you explain that? Did you have to do it with
I mean, the point is, this didn't affect us. It only affected the people in the sort of, I think it was radar and this sort of stuff, like, you know.
The calibration of the radar, not the guns?
No, it wasn't the guns. No, it was the calibration of radar and stuff like that. And the RSC was playing up, and for 5 days, those lads were right. The colour on my face did change. For 5 days, I was absolutely bloody wretched. We was diesel electric. And as you came out up onto the upper deck, there was vents that came from the engine room, or where they stored the oil. And the point was that the oil fumes, the diesel oil fumes, and your stomach's just settled down nice, and you come up and you open the bulkhead door to come out and get the whiff full of that. And, oh, bloody on me, off you go again. And there was one other thing, and that is that, I don't know why, but on that trip, at least twice, they decided we was having boiled eggs for breakfast.